It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Things are getting crowded for Republican presidential contenders, with Rick Perry and Lindsey Graham both announcing their plans to join the race. First, it's an already massive recall of vehicles in the United States got even bigger this week as Japanese manufacturer Takata continues to face pressure for federal regulators over faulty airbags.
The company has already recalled airbags used in about 18 million vehicles for the problem. The latest move will almost double that number, bringing it to up around 34 million, making it the single largest automotive recall in American history and among the largest recalls for all consumer products. Glenn Bauer joins us now. He's a mechanical engineering faculty associate at UW-Madison. Glenn, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So we're looking at what looks to be the largest automotive recall in American history, thanks to airbags. What do we know about the problem so far?
Well, the problem has to do with the base propellant that they use, and the fact that it is sensitive to temperature and moisture. And what happens is the volume of the propellant changes with temperature and moisture, and then it can get into, if it gets too condensed when it goes off, it reacts too quickly. And when that occurs, then what happens is it's overpressuring the metal container that it was designed for. And so that's the root cause of these accidents.
And there have been injuries and even deaths associated with this issue. It sounds as though, some graphic language that I've heard, that the victims look like they've been stabbed.
Correct. So there's a metal container that's supposed to take care of the initial, we'll call it explosion, which is basically what you're doing. From there, you vent it through some, actually some dust that actually then lowers the temperature of that rushing gas, that high-pressure gas, and then that allows it to not melt the airbag material itself. And so what's happening is when this gets too high a pressure, it actually then creates metal shrapnel from that metal container, and then that is what is basically impaling the people in the cars.
Now, are you saying that what's triggering this is basically sort of a moisture temperature issue, or is there also a motion factor involved?
Well, most of the consensus is that it's the base propellant itself, and that's what most people are thinking. And if you look at the statistics, a majority, like 25% of the injuries and deaths, are in the Florida region, which is a region of the country known for high humidity during the summer and higher temperatures.
Now, this has been an ongoing issue, but it was this week that the big news broke that Takata had to double the amount of vehicles that were going to be targeted for the recall. What happened to broaden that big number?
I think it, just looking at some of the reports, it was there were some changes in the people that were in charge of the Federal Highway Safety Standard Committee. And from that, I mean, what's happening is some of the automotive manufacturers on their own basically decided to recall the vehicles because they didn't want to be blemishing their names and their brands.
We're talking right now with Glenn Bauer of UW-Madison, talking about the latest news on the Takata auto recall related to airbags. And Glenn, the name Takata, not necessarily recognizable to a lot of people at first, maybe some confusion about whether this was an automobile manufacturer that people hadn't heard much about, and now we find out that it's an airbag manufacturer linked to lots of different brands. What do we know about the company?
I don't know, other than it's a Japanese company and they're what we call a tier one supplier, so somebody that supplies directly to the automotive industry would be in that boat. And so I did a little other research, and it turns out that this is a large recall, but then in the United States, TRW, Delphi, and another company that is the biggest in Europe, Autoliv, are the other kind of three big airbag suppliers in the United States.
Well, the big question people want to know is this going to affect my car? Is my car going to be recalled for this? What do we know about which cars are included so far?
Some of the automotive manufacturers self-identified that they had these questionable airbags, and they've already issued their own recalls. And then on top of here, what will happen then is through the agency, they're going to go through and decide what other models will be recalled. And they haven't determined that yet. They said that would be released in the next day or two.
Do we know back to what year we're talking about?
It looks like it was the early 2000s. And I don't know if it was 2002 or 2003, but somewhere in that time frame.
Now, Honda, say, is one manufacturer that I've seen that has said, yes, our cars have some of these airbags. So what should someone do if they think that this is their vehicle that might be affected?
Well, it will take, for this size of recall, it's going to take several years to basically get all of these replaced. And so some of it has to do with how many of these exist inside of, like, Ford or Honda's part system. So if they have a fairly large number in that part system, then they can do a lot of the recalls right away. If they have to wait for Takata to make replacement units, then that's going to delay the process. And then the last part will just be the fact that, you know, if these vehicles are 10 years old, they may be on their second or third owner, and so just getting word to those people that their car is involved in a recall and then they need to get this airbag replaced will be kind of the harder part, and that's the public awareness.
Now, let's look just at the monetary side of it. Let's say someone has a car that needs to be recalled due to this airbag Takata issue. Do they have to pay anything for it, any labor costs, any sort of extra parts cost, or is that all going to be paid for?
Typically, if it's a warranty recall like this and a safety item, there is no cost to the owner of the vehicle.
And are there any other issues that people should know about, backlogs in wait time, service time, that they should maybe be aware could come down the pike?
I'm not really an expert on that. I mean, I believe an airbag would, you know, take an hour and a half to replace.
So in terms of a convenience aspect to the consumer, would you call it middling to minor?
Well, depending upon how you look at it.
As far as
can easily take your car in and get it back the same day.
Okay. Well, and from a consumer standpoint, we've seen some of these big recalls recently, General Motors, Toyota. This case seems different. What kind of reaction have people had so far about it?
Well, I haven't got personally, you know, a lot of it. I mean, just what I can look on the social media type websites and such. So I think, you know, it's just people are, once again, they hear the stories of these airbags and the injuries they've done. Now, it's not, I mean, in the overall scheme of things, for the number of accidents in the year and the number of airbag deployments, this isn't a large number, but it's still the fact that we've seen more than 5 deaths occurred because of this.
Now, the automakers themselves, do they carry any of the blame for this, or do you think it will be largely directed at Takata?
Well, because the automotive companies take a product and put it in their car, if there's a lawsuit, they will be suing both Takata and the company that installed it into their vehicle.
Okay, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Glenn Bauer. He's a mechanical engineering faculty associate at UW-Madison. He joined us to discuss the latest news on the largest auto recall in American history with Takata airbags.
And we'd love to hear from you if you have heard so far, or when you do hear, if your car is being affected, if you get the news about this recall. Send us a message over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know if and when you get the word, if you here in Wisconsin are one of the people affected by this major, largest recall in auto history, it looks like. We head to Washington for our weekly look at the latest in Congress and national politics. The countdown to June 1st continues when the parts of the Patriot Act authorizing the NSA's bulk collection of phone data will expire. The Senate is set to vote on a bill that would modify that authority this week.
And there's more news from the campaign trail. Things are getting crowded in the Republican field as Rick Perry and Lindsey Graham have both signaled that they plan to announce they're running for president in early June. And yesterday, Hillary Clinton took questions from the press for the first time in about a month.
Joining us now is Ken Vogel, chief investigative correspondent for Politico. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys.
Well, let's start with Hillary Clinton. First, questions from the press evidently in a month. Is that being taken as a sign that she's been dodging the press in any way?
Well, in fact, the way that she frames it is that she wants to talk to voters and that she is focused on talking with regular folks, and in the course of one of these small round tables that she had, her campaign had set up, in fact, one of the reporters who was following her around with this giant pack of reporters tried to interject and ask a question, and she had really an offhanded, almost dismissive response where she said, you know, I'm focused on talking with these people. Maybe I'll talk to you after I'm done. I'll take it under advisement. And all the regular voters who were sort of handpicked to come and attend kind of got a chuckle out of it. But the press got its hackles up a little bit and, you know, took a stand and made it clear that they really wanted to have a chance to ask her some questions. So she took some questions. I think it's going to be a struggle for the next 538 days or whatever it is until the general election, assuming that she is the Democratic nominee. And we're going to have a lot of this tension between her campaign and the media pack that follows her.
A lot of the questions that did get asked focused on her use of a private email account while at the State Department. This week, a federal court said that waiting until January of next year, too long a wait. Clinton says she wants those emails released by the State Department as soon as possible. Are these emails a challenge, a roadblock for her campaign?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it is horrible timing for her. She would prefer to just rip the Band-Aid off and get all this stuff out there now while we in the media are paying a lot of attention and are really anxious for any additional information about this controversy. But voters are paying a lot less attention. And so were these emails to come out now and all the news stories that would be based on the combing through these emails to come out now, it would be preferable to her because she could sort of get it behind her. Instead, it's these emails, if this court order holds, are going to come out just in the weeks before the Iowa caucus, which is really when folks are going to be, for the first time, tuning in an intensive way. So, too, will these congressional hearings about the Benghazi attacks be delayed until much closer to the sort of official beginning of the campaign? In both these instances, she would rather get these things over with. It extends the life of these stories and then gives them renewed life when there are, in fact, developments at the least opportune moment for her.
For Hillary Clinton's critics and maybe potential primary opponents, runoff opponents, is there a wish list? Are there things that they're hoping to see in these emails that would be particularly potentially damaging to her campaign?
I think there's just this general question about the confluence between her foundation's work, money contributions to her family's foundation, payments to her husband for speaking fees and maybe other business relationships, and her work as Secretary of State. We've already seen a few examples of this. Obviously, there was the book by the conservative author Peter Schweitzer that made allegations that these donations and these payments to her husband or to the foundation were influencing her time and her direction of the State Department while she was Secretary of State. Of course, we haven't seen any definitive evidence of that, but what we have seen from these emails and what we expect to potentially see is more information that kind of gets at this confluence. And we saw a story in the New York Times just this week about emails from this private account showing that Hillary Clinton was accepting advice from Sidney Blumenthal, a former advisor to her president, who was on the payroll of the Clinton Foundation, who was advising her on the situation in Libya as he was working with companies that were seeking to get in on the on reconstruction work in Libya. So there you see the blurring of the business lines with the political, with the official government service, with the foundation. I think that's the kind of thing that Republicans and critics certainly hope is sort of borne out and fleshed out by these emails.
Talking to Ken Vogel, chief investigative correspondent for Politico, about the top political news stories going on this week in national politics. Let's go to the other side of this presidential race, Ken. The Republicans, two candidates of the future announcing that they would announce their runs in the near future, Rick Perry, Lindsey Graham. Why this pre-announcement? Why announce that you're going to announce?
Yeah, this is sort of part of the kabuki theater that we now see around launching presidential campaigns. There are a lot of campaign finance implications. If you do launch your campaign, you have to set up a campaign committee. You're limited in what you could do in terms of raising money, and you're limited in your ability to interact with this unlimited so-called soft money that the super PACs and the other outside groups are able to raise. So it behooves you to put off actually officially announcing your candidacy and beginning your campaign as long as possible. We see that in a way that sort of defies credulity at this point with Jeb Bush, who, from a lay perspective, clearly is running for president, but nonetheless continues to insist that he's not. Campaign finance watchdogs say this is really sort of defies the spirit of these laws that are set up to ensure that candidates, officially declared candidates, are not able to participate in this sort of big outside money fundraising that Jeb Bush is very much involved in and taking great advantage of.
Now, I think a lot of people suspected that Rick Perry was going to run again. Lindsey Graham maybe not gotten as much attention, but he's from South Carolina, an early primary state in a crowded field. Could that help him stand out?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really, in some ways, Republicans' worst nightmare, that they would have such a crowded field with so many candidates who, you know, some of whom are credible, some of whom are less credible, but are going to take shots at and maybe damage the credible candidates who are more likely to eventually come through the process with the party's nomination. We saw this, of course, in 2012 with Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum continuing to hang on to the specter of their candidacies and really taking shots at Mitt Romney, dragging him to the right in some ways in a way that hurt his eventual chances of in the general election versus Barack Obama. I mean, in this case, with Lindsey Graham and Rick Perry, you're seeing, certainly with Lindsey Graham, maybe a little less so with Rick Perry, the chance for a really robust debate around national security and foreign policy issues with a true hawk neoconservative champion like Lindsey Graham going up against Rand Paul, another more viable candidate potentially, but one who is more from the libertarian Tea Party wing of the party that espouses a much more non-interventionist foreign policy and a much more civil liberties-focused domestic national security policy. Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul have already gone at it over some of these issues, and I think we can expect to see a lot more of that over the course of many months if Lindsey Graham really gets into the race.
Well, that hawk versus civil liberties split there takes us to our next story. This one from Congress. The Senate getting ready to vote on the USA Freedom Act, passed by the U.S. House already. This would modify the NSA's authority to collect bulk phone data. What's the likelihood of that passing on the Senate side?
It seems rather unlikely at this point. Our sources who track these votes think that it's probably not going to pass, and that will potentially play into Mitch McConnell's hands, the Senate majority leader, who wants to pass just a straight extension of the Patriot Act that doesn't have these provisions in it that dial back the NSA's ability to collect this bulk data. So he would prefer to have the fight now, have the vote fail, and then be able to pass an extension of the Patriot Act. He might not even get that chance to have the vote in the first place for a while because Rand Paul, the aforementioned civil libertarian, is on the floor right now doing what his office is calling a filibuster. There's actually no vote up, so it's technically not a filibuster, but nonetheless, he is using the platform to make a point that he thinks that not only is the Patriot Act sort of too much of a violation of civil liberties and giving the government too much control to eavesdrop on private citizens, but he doesn't even think that these more modified dial-back provisions in this USA Freedom Act are sufficiently non-intrusive. He would rather see a vote on the Patriot Act that opposed the extension of the Patriot Act on its merits. And this is another example of a really robust debate that we haven't seen for a while, not just on the Republican side, but really throughout the American body politic on this balance between national security and civil liberties. I mean, we're seeing a debate about the justification for war with Iraq again. It really is sort of like deja vu from 2008 with Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush debating, sort of reframing their original opinions in support of the justification for war. So it's after a long period during which these issues kind of faded from the fore in the political debate, they are right back up there again in everyone's face in a way that's probably healthy to have this kind of debate on.
I was going to say, Ken, a lot of times we gripe about the presidential race starting earlier and earlier, but in this case, it's putting a spotlight on issues that that maybe are worthy of this kind of robust debate.
Yeah, that's right. And Hillary Clinton, I mean, I covered her campaign in 2008 and can't even count the number of times that she was asked about her decision to vote in favor of the authorization of the war in Iraq and kind of parried the questions and deflected and never really admitted her Democratic Party, her sort of perspective of the Democratic Party, that it was a mistake from that point of view. Now she is admitting that it was a mistake, and she says she regrets it. Jeb Bush was sort of stumbled over the same question recently and said that he would have voted for authorization. Now he's saying, no, he misunderstood the question. It's not quite that simple. You have Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, folks who are more overtly identified with the hawkish wing of the Republican Party, saying, oh, yeah, we would vote for it. And it is really a healthy and robust debate.
And we'll leave it there, Ken. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
That's Ken Vogel, chief investigative correspondent for Politico, in our weekly look at the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Schools have a lot on their plate these days, with more attention to standards and accountability and calls to teach the basics with a focus on reading, writing, and math, and more demand for STEM education to prepare students for careers in science and technology.
Our next guest says we often lose sight of what he says should be a core mission of schools: teaching students to be the citizens of the future. And not just any kind of citizens, thoughtful, engaged, critical thinkers who take an active role in representative government.
Joel Westheimer joins us now. He's a professor and research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa. His newest book is called What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, early on, you say one important question is not so much whether schools teach citizenship, but how they teach citizenship. And you lay out three kinds of citizens we could be training. What do you make of the different kinds?
Yeah, you know, so Joe, this builds on research that my colleague Joe Kahn and I did over many years across the country, and we looked at a whole bunch of programs that say that they're teaching good citizenship. And we were interested in, you know, if you go out into the street and you ask 100 people whether they think schools should teach kids to be good citizens, you'll get a lot of head nodding, a lot of people saying, you know, sure. But if you ask a little deeper than that, you know, well, what does that mean? What is a good citizen to you, or what exactly should schools teach? That's when you start to get disagreements and the sparks start to fly. And I think that's because when we talk about visions of what schools should teach, we're really talking about what we think the ideal society is, what kind of society we want to live in. And those are our deep questions. And we looked at a bunch of programs and decided that there were a lot of very different kinds of programs out there with different kinds of goals. And what we found that was that most of them could be described by these three visions of a good citizen, because, you know, professors love to categorize things like that. So it doesn't mean that every program fits neatly into one of the categories, but it's a helpful way of looking at them. And the three that we called them was the personally responsible citizen, the participatory citizen, as in participation, and the social justice-oriented citizen. And I'll tell you just a little bit about each one. The personally responsible citizen programs were ones that wanted kids to be personally responsible, to not litter or to show up to work on time, to pay taxes, to be nice to their friends and neighbors, to help an old person across the street or give blood when there's a blood drive, things like that. And there's a lot of programs that aim towards those. Some of your listeners might think of them as character education programs, where you build good character and you teach people, you know, to be good to good people, the kind of people you'd want to live next door to. Fewer programs aimed at this different vision of citizenship, which was participatory or participation. And those were ones that wanted to teach kids about how government works, how community agencies work, and how they can get involved in their community and help organize things. So, for example, if participatory citizens were organizing a food drive, the personally responsible citizens would be showing up and donating a can of food because they're good people, right? And the last vision of citizenship, which was the least commonly represented in schools, we called social justice oriented because these were programs that explicitly aimed at having kids look at the root causes of problems. These programs want kids to know how government works and to be personally responsible, but also to get at the causes of some of the major issues that we face today and look at the controversies around those and the different possible solutions. So if I use that metaphor I was using before, if the participatory citizens are organizing a food drive, the personally responsible citizens are donating a can of food, then the social justice-oriented citizens are asking, how come in one of the richest countries in the world we have people who are hungry? And what can we do about that? They're asking, getting to the root causes. And I think that all three of these visions of citizenship are important, but they're not all equally represented in schools.
Right, and on the face of it, all of these look like good models for citizenship, but when we take the personally responsible citizen, the one who is donating the food, say, at the food drive, you think that's not enough. Why?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because, of course, that's a good thing. No one could be against people volunteering at a soup kitchen or donating a can of food or doing any of those things. But one of the things I like to ask people when I'm giving a talk or speaking with parents or educators is what makes our schools in the United States different from schools, let's say, in a totalitarian dictatorship or a military dictatorship or an authoritarian regime? So is there anything that should be different in schools about schools in the United States than there are in schools in, say, North Korea or China or Indonesia? A lot of people would like to say, well, of course, I mean, American schools have to be different because we're a democratic society. But when you think about those goals of the personally responsible citizen, there is not a country in the world on the planet that wouldn't be happy if the citizens of that country didn't litter, were honest or paid their taxes or didn't do drugs or showed up to school on time. Every country in the world wants that, and of course we want that too. But we have to want something more, because a democratic society requires citizens to participate in a way that an authoritarian regime doesn't. An authoritarian regime counts on one vision of truth handed down by either a religious leader or a military leader or a king or a queen. And we count on citizens themselves being involved in crafting our own future. So it's like that famous Thomas Jefferson quote, if the citizens are not well educated enough to govern their own affairs, the solution is not to take that power of governance away from them, but rather to educate them. And that really formed one of the founding purposes of public education in the United States. And it's one of the purposes of public education that I think we've lost in this current decade of school reform.
Right. So if you look at an education system that's looking at turning out social justice-oriented citizens, you're going to have kids, students who know their history, who know various perspectives, not just one perspective. They're going to have to be taught to be critical thinkers. Do you see that happening now?
That's absolutely right, and unfortunately, it is happening in small ways in individual classrooms with excellent teachers across the country, but all those teachers who are teaching critical thinking are doing it in spite of what's happening in the broader education reform. One of the chapters in my book that you mentioned at the opening, What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good, one of the chapters is titled No Child Left Thinking, which is a play on the No Child Left Behind Act. I know some teachers actually call it No Child Left Untested. A few teachers I've met call it No Child Left, which is actually one of my favorite names for it. But I call it No Child Left Thinking because I want to draw attention to the ways that legislation and others like it, Race to the Top, and even now the Common Core policies, have caused a restriction in critical thinking in the classroom because they focused an endless amount of time on preparation for, you know, months and months of preparation for taking standardized tests in only two subject areas, math and literacy. And in the process, we've pushed to the background or off the table altogether other subject areas and deeper critical thinking in all the subject areas because we want kids to be able to regurgitate answers on these tests.
And what do you think the consequences of that are to a citizenry that you're trying to prepare for the future, to tackle problems, to ask critical questions? What is the effect, do you think, of putting an emphasis on standardized tests? And, of course, advocates of that would say you want kids to have a body of knowledge that's common, that will prepare them for college and a career. But what happens then, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that the consequences are that we lose a bit of the strength of our democracy because we are teaching kids that the purposes of school is just career training, individual gain, and so forth. And of course, those have always been part of schooling, but they've only been a part. Schooling was also about teaching kids about their place in society and what role they can play and how they can help to improve society. So that's, you know, the for the common good part of the book title. It is true that you said, and I'm glad you brought that up, that of course we want schools to teach what's often called the basics. And sometimes I say to people, you know, please raise your hand if you are a member of the group Parents and Educators Against Kids Knowing How to Read. And no one raises their hand, of course, because there is no such group. I've never met a teacher who doesn't care whether a kid can read or add numbers. The problem comes when we stop there, that we all care whether kids can read, and we all want kids to learn how to read, but many teachers also want kids to know what's worth reading and to know how what they're reading pertains to their daily life and to our society at large. We want kids to be able to add numbers, of course, but we also want them to think about what those numbers add up to and how those numbers create meaning for what they're going to do in the world. And so what we're really suffering from right now is a kind of poverty of the imagination about what the goals of schooling can be for. And we need to, yes, teach the basics. Nobody's against that. But also link those to a much broader vision of what the purpose of schooling is in our society.
We're talking right now with Joel Westheimer about his new book. It's called What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think schools should focus on critical thinking and the role of citizens? How should these things be taught? Do you think standardized testing is stifling that mission? And if you work in education, how does this play out at your school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Joel Westheimer. His new book is called What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. He says our schools should be teaching kids how to be thoughtful, critical thinkers and to prepare them to embrace the role of an active citizen.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that citizenship and the role of citizens in a democratic society should be a focus, a mission in our schools? Do you think it gets enough attention in the age of standardized testing? How does this work in the school that you work at, attend, or send your kids to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
And Joel, as we talk about preparing kids to be educated citizens, one thing that seems clear, it's not a simple enterprise. It's something that is going to take time, and that means classroom instruction time. And we've got this age that we live in now when we have this competitive global marketplace. We don't want kids falling behind in math, in science. Does citizen-focused education prepare kids, do you think, for that kind of global competition that it seems we're going to be facing and already are facing?
Well, it's funny. People always talk about this global competition and 21st century learning and so forth, and yet it's always talked about through the lens of a kind of 19th century model of what education is. So, for example, there's an enormous emphasis now on kids acquiring amounts of information, bits of facts and knowledge that they need to apparently, you know, to, the claim is to compete in the global economy. The funny thing is that we all carry around devices in our pockets that can get any piece of information we need in about 3 or 4 seconds. And it's not actually a lack of information that we have a problem with. It's too much information. And what kids need to learn is how to figure out what information is worthwhile, what the different perspectives for different information are, where it comes from, the motivations behind emphasizing certain kinds of information and not emphasizing other kinds of information. And these are the kind of skills you learn when you take critical analysis and critical thinking seriously. And it's the kind of skills that are more appropriate for our society today than they ever have been before. Now, no one thinks that kids don't need any information or any facts. What they do need is a way of understanding how to interpret information and how to sort through vast amounts of information, because all of us are flooded with huge quantities of information every day.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got Jonathan with us in Minneapolis. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
One of the comments that I heard just now, especially with the concept of technology at our fingertips, what I say to my students is, it's not my job to give information, but to interpret information. When you have hundreds of thousands of web pages that can contradict one another from the first search to the second, it's about how do we read those information. I think that the critical thinking skills really need to take precedence when information is so abundant. How do you interpret that information? And when we teach a generation of kids how to answer a question, we need to also tell them what to do with the information that we give them. I think that's something that Common Core doesn't address.
And Jonathan, just real quickly before I let you go, do you think there is a common basis out there among educators about how to teach critical thinking?
I think that critical thinking skills take us all the way back to the classics that we read. A classic style, for example, does not get lost through the years, but the ability for a student to understand that classic is what's getting thrown off. I think that most educators believe that there is a correct system, but it's when you're trying to evaluate it with a system that we know doesn't work as far as a test on bubbles isn't really going to get the critical thinking skills proven to our students, because governments don't care to see that result.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. And Joel, what do you think about that, about looking for critical thinking as being the most important thing, just as you were saying? And do you think that there's agreement on how to teach critical thinking?
Well, I think that our schools need a lot more teachers like Jonathan, so I'm glad to hear that he is a teacher. I think he's absolutely right that it's interpretation is the kind of skills we need. And then I do want to say something about whether there's this one best way to teach critical thinking, because I think the answer to that is no. And the clear issue here is that there's not one best way to teach anything, which is what the problem of standardization is. You know, on the one hand, we keep talking about standards and accountability. And in some sense, I've never met a teacher who didn't have standards or who didn't feel accountable. You know, teachers feel accountable to their students, to the parents, to the school, to the community. The problem's not with standards or accountability. The problem is with standardization. Because standardization means making everything the same. And as soon as we try and standardize the curriculum so that it's easier to digest for performing on the bubble tests, as Jonathan called them, as soon as we do that, we're trying to make teachers interchangeable, like assembly line workers. And that simply takes the best of education and brings everything down to a lowest common denominator and saps the passion out of it. We want a teacher like Jonathan to be able to draw on his particular skills and talents and his students' experiences to build the best kind of educational environment that he can. And we want another teacher to do that same task, but differently, drawing on their interests and passions and their students' interests and passions and experiences. So there's nothing, no problem with standards or accountability, but when it comes to trying to make education all the same, like McDonald's, that's where we run into problems.
We're talking to Joel Westheimer, professor and research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa. His newest book is What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good. Let's get another quick call in. Eric joins us in Stoughton. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Fascinating topic and one near to my heart. I'm a university professor at a two-year school, so freshman and sophomore. I get them right out of high school. And I have one comment and then a question. My concern is that we're losing the ability to solve problems, the ability to look at a situation or a problem and identify the things that we know and the things that we don't know and how to deal with those. But from a civic standpoint, the politicization of information, particularly knowledge, has become a real problem. Students aren't equipped to identify what's bias and what's trying to gather their attention and influence their opinions and what's actual real tested, validated information. It's very frustrating.
And we're going to leave that there before your question, Eric, because we're running short of time. And briefly, Joel, what would you say to that?
Yeah, so what's interesting about what Eric said is this idea of the politicization of knowledge. And in one sense, he's using the term politics in this way that's become popular in our culture, which is as like a four-letter word. Like if I say, oh, God, Veronica, you're just being political, it's like you're a mudslinging candidate running for office and you just care about your own advancement. But the word politics has a much richer history and, in fact, was a positive term. Bernard Crick, in his famous book, In Defense of Politics, said that politics was a great civilizing activity. It was the way that people in a democratic society come together to work out their differences and move forward with social policy. And so I think Eric is absolutely right in the sense that we need to teach kids critical thinking and analysis of political issues. But when people say, you know, we need to keep politics out of the school, I actually think we need to put politics back into the school.
And we leave it there. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely, Veronica. It was my pleasure.
That was Joel Westheimer, professor and research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa. His newest book is called What Kind of Citizen? Educating Our Children for the Common Good.
If you click on a top 10 list today, or a listicle as they're called in our modern space, AG Times, you should stop and give a nod to David Letterman.
Not only is it Letterman's last night on the air tonight, but it's an apropos time to remember his contributions to pop culture. Early on in the days of the show, Letterman and his writers launched what would be a staple of the show, one of its signatures, the top 10 list. And it became a signature as well in pop culture. And this first one made fun of top 10 lists. It all began with 1995's top 10 things that almost rhyme with peas. Here it is.
Number 10, we have heats. Number 9 is rice. Number 8 is moss. Number 7, we have pies.
Well, it's a little late.
What happened?
We were going to score this whole thing for you.
A little drum roll. Number 6 is needs. Number 5 is lens. Number 4 is ice. Number 3 is kind of a surprise, nurse. Number 2, we're getting very close now, is leaks. And the number one word that almost rhymes with peas, according to our poll, is meats.
It's the top 10 list that started it all in 1985 with David Letterman. I think I may have seen that one when it was on, believe it or not, the first ever top 10 list.
Are you going to watch tonight?
Probably not. It's past my bedtime.
All right. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.